Survivor Specialist John and McKenna are back to rewind episode 9 of season 47. We are going to talk this episode of season 47, but with some past moments sprinkled in that remind us of some outwit, outplay, and outlast moments of the episode. John, let's talk the episode. What are your thoughts?
Well, before we do, everyone make sure you like the video and subscribe to the channel. It really helps us out there with the algorithm and everything. This was a saddening episode of Survivor 47 for me. We lost our man, Saul. And it's one of the rare episodes where in the preview from last week, we get the name tossed out. And that person is, in fact, the target for the entire episode. So it was interesting. It's always interesting to see an episode edited this way when it does seem like there is an obvious target. And then we get that last minute scramble. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And even like the elements of it that I was not too hot on, like four people losing their vote. Okay, it's actually only one person, but you said it was four. Almost feels like
just we've had this before, though, of like all of you lose your vote, but you have a chance to earn it back. But it wasn't like this, where I liked this version of it better because there was a guarantee that three were going to have their votes back. Where like yeah. Before it was like, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
But that's the interesting thing about this, and that's why it almost feels like Jeff lying to them, because it's not really Jeff lying to them, but because the last time it happened on 45, each person had to compete individually to get their vote back, it felt like everyone was assuming no one's coming back with a vote. Hopefully someone does, but like we're not guaranteeing it. Whereas in this case, we have three people absolutely coming back with their vote. So it's really rough for the contestants not to be able to plan with that in mind, right? Because you have six people on the beach with four people eating BLTs and two people just sitting at camp, mm-hmm. trying to figure out how many votes they need to run this tribal council with no idea that there's a total of 9 when there's a potential of a 6 to 10. Right? It doesn't lead to the greatest gameplay. Luckily, we kind of got some great gameplay out of it. And I think that's really just wholly on mm-hmm. the cast of 47 rather than this twist itself.
Yeah. So let's start with the outwit moment of the episode. We were talking about flipping on your OG tribe at the merge. We saw it last episode. We saw it this episode. So we kind of wanted to talk do's and don'ts, like when it works out for people and when it doesn't, because, you know, there is that fine line of, is this the right time to do this? Or, you know, will it just end in me going home a few votes later?
So with that in mind, what's your prediction of how this is going to reflect on Genevieve moving forward?
I don't think it's going to end well for Genevieve. I think she's going to get looked at as a big strategic threat unless she pulls an Alligabler and just like ducks down and keeps her head down for a good few votes.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how to look at it because there were a couple of moments in this episode that were contradictory to each other. In the early part of the episode, we have Kyle's confessional where he says, oh, I don't view Genevieve as a strategic player at all. And we, the audience, are like, yeah, okay. Good read there, Kyle. But later on, when this plan's being put out there and it's being proposed to Gabe and Kyle, Gabe's like, this is all you, Genevieve. So it seems like she's being clocked by some people, but not by mm-hmm. other people. And even if we go back 2 weeks, was it 2 weeks ago? I think so. Andy, when he was having that conversation, yeah, it was after the Rome vote where Andy was having that conversation with Genevieve and he was like, I don't think I could pick Genevieve out of a crowd. So it's very interesting because we're kind of getting this story of like, okay, some people are picking up on Genevieve, but other mm-hmm. people aren't. And how is that going to impact her moving forward here? Especially because she voted out Saul, who seemed very willing to work with her.
And yeah, he was all in on Lavo.
Yeah, and alienated Teenie in the process. So I don't know if we're just not seeing how close Genevieve is with the Tukus, or maybe she's much closer
maybe
with Andy than we're being shown.
Just like bonded and like they can run, you know, the rest of the game. But I have my moment, and that is Sherry voting out her fans and flipping to the favorites. I think this is not a good move for Sherry, though this is like, it's one of those riding the middle decisions where it could be looked at as good because she made it to Final Tribal Council, but I feel like it's bad because she went to Final Tribal Council with two people that could beat her handedly and did.
It's really It's really interesting when you look at Caramon just as a season and the way you're supposed to approach it. Obviously, the favorites dominate that season. We have the few, there's what, four fans who make it to the merge? That doesn't seem right. Is that right? Is there only four of them?
Sherry, Michael, Eddie, Reynolds.
That's it, right? So there's the four of them. And obviously, it's a sinking ship. So it makes sense to switch over to the favorites. You know the favorites have already built these connections. There's this massive alliance on the other side in Stealth R Us. And they're offering you this olive branch. Like, come in, replace Corinne, and be a part of our alliance. So it's an interesting situation to find yourself in. Yes, it gets her to the end of the game, which, I mean, to some is kind of a win, right? Like, maybe
this example is so like treading the line of like, is this a good move or is this a bad move? But if you might get some like, I don't know, just making it to Final Tribal Council is a feat, but when you're just drawing as dead in the water as Sherry was, like, you need a Michael Snow on your side to... Now, he could have also won, too, but, like, she has a better shot against, you know, Michael Snow and Eddie than she does against Cochran and Dawn, because also some of the fans on the jury, you know, might want to lean more towards a familiar face, too. So if you have these non-familiar faces in the fans, then you should be able to pitch your case a little bit better, and some of the points that Sherry was making could have hit a little bit harder had she not been against Cochran.
I think one of the big things with Sherry in this instance and why it lands more on the bad move, Sherry really becomes a passenger in the game and is at the whim of the favorites at this point. Even if we look at like the final six vote, I think that's what the family visit is. Like, the family visit, Brenda going there is kind of what ensures Sherry the seat at Final Tribal Council. If, for some reason, that doesn't happen, and Dawn doesn't decide, okay, we need to get rid of Brenda here, I don't even know if Sherry sits at the end. Yes, she's kind of this goat that you can take to the end, and because of the lack of fans in that merge, you don't have to worry about, like, OG tribes voting for her instead. But I think, like, it doesn't feel like she has any of that agency and urgency in her game, which makes her getting to the end her own thing, which really hampers her ability to win the game. Whereas if she kind of stood up for herself, maybe that gains more respect from the favorites. Yes, it could be riskier, and she doesn't necessarily sit at the end, but her win equity at getting to the end could be higher.
Right. Exactly. And she also is faced with another opportunity when she doesn't go with Malcolm, Eddie, and Reynolds. We've talked about this moment before, but she also faces like that choice too, where she could have maybe made a decision that could have impacted her game a little bit better and not voted out Eddie and Reynolds to fans. And maybe gotten, you know, a better outcome. But again, this is all like hearsay for Sherry, but
yeah,
like,
it's all hypothetical at this point, and that's kind of the hard thing about it. But the point of the matter is like, I don't know if switching on your tribe when you're in the lesser numbers is always the best thing. In fact, most of the time in Survivor history, we often see it being the opposite. right? Where we see a tribe goes into the merge with less numbers, and it actually is beneficial for that tribe. Thinking of like the Matsings, thinking of Foa Foa, even like more recently, right? Like Pika, like these numbers of like being smaller has proven to be beneficial going into the merge. Even Lavo up until today. I don't think if Genevieve didn't put Saul's name out, he would have gone.
Everyone wants to work with Lavo.
Yeah. And even Sam, who is like, oh, I'm going to get my revenge on Lavo for this. Yeah. Like he still understands the value of this smaller tribe. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just one of these things when it comes to flipping on that original tribe, which is kind of this like risky venture you have to make.
Yeah. So John, talk about a moment that worked out for the tribe flip. What is your moment for the week?
You know, let's go back to the original fans versus favorites here, and let's talk about the Aussie blind side, because I think that is one of those pivotal moments of there was a strong alliance, obviously. There was a strong alliance of five of Aussie, Parvi, Amanda, James, and Sari coming from that original favorites tribe. And obviously, the tribe swap kind of helped switch things up a bit. It got us into an instance where, you know, Parvati kind of built that relationship with Alexis and Natalie. And that was really important going into this merge. But Cerise's decision to flip on Aussie here almost won her this game. And that can't be understated. Because if this wasn't a final two, I think there's very few questions of whether or not Cerise wins Micronesia if this isn't a final two. And this is a move that gets her there. She's taken out of time. And obviously, yes, there are other things that help. James being medevaced and things like that. But taking out this challenge threat at a point where he had an idol that he did not play. And he felt so secure in the game based on his social relationships, which felt like an improvement over the Aussie from Cook Islands. It felt like he actually had social relationships and wasn't just like part of the tribe. In this season, Sri pulled one over on him, and it propelled the Black Widow Brigade into being the greatest all-female alliance in Survivor history.
Yeah, and I feel like Parv and Genevieve are alike in this situation, where Parv gets rid of Ozzy, alienating Amanda, but Amanda realizes, well, I've got nowhere else to go. So, but unlike Amanda, I feel like Teenie has options.
It's really weird. It's hard to gauge where Teenie is in the game at this point, because they are really connected with everyone. It seems like they're very well liked in the season.
Mm-hmm.
But everything we're being shown in the edit shows them as kind of on the outs, no power, no... I don't want to say sense of agency, because I do think Teenie does have agency, but there's no sway. Like, they don't have the ability to push a vote. And we kind of saw that last week when the decision between Sierra, Sam, and Rachel came up. Teenie was pushing really hard for it to be Sam, and ultimately it still falls on Sierra, the one person they didn't want to go home.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see next week if this works out for Genevieve, if this works out for Teenie, because obviously Saul going was Teenie's number one, Ozzy going was Amanda's number one, and we'll see how everyone rebounds after this, after the dust settles.
It's a big question. I mean, I think Teenie has a better chance of winning Final Tribal Council if they get to the end than Amanda did, because I think Teenie can actually rock at one. But I don't know. Maybe this is just like that catalyst that gets Teenie to really start pushing even harder in the game and moving forward. It's just going to be interesting to see what happens with Genevieve here. Because like you said, Genevieve could be in that Parvati role where it's someone taking over the game, really forming alliances. But again, we aren't seeing that in 47. We aren't seeing anything like, that really...
Alexis and Natalie could be like the Sue and Caroline.
Very possible. We just don't know enough of some of these relationships, like these intertribal relationships in this post-merge, to really get a good idea of exactly how this is going to unfold.
Yes. All right. So we are moving on to our outplay moment of the week, and we're going to talk puzzle steps because this is a great challenge, one that I love. And it actually originated a lot earlier than I thought. And it's actually the episode we are watching for the Patreon, for the patrons over there on Patreon. So become a patron. We always have a bonus episode for the Rewind every week. We watch a past episode of Survivor that relates closely to this episode of 47. And we're watching Thailand episode 13, The Tides Are Turning. And John, I'm going to have you kick off your outplay moment.
Well, I mean, we're going to go back. Yeah, we're going back to the original instance of this challenge. And I like the puzzle steps. There's an interesting facet to this challenge. And I this is the first time we've seen it run in pairs, which was very interesting. It kind of changed the strategy. We saw how Sue and Genevieve communicated really well about the pieces so that one of them would go place a piece. They would communicate what the next piece looked like. And the other would be finding that piece as that person came back, which gave them a really good flow and let them very much dominate that part. And if it wasn't for them taking too much time, probably because honestly, I think they felt like they had too much of a cushion when it came to that balance beam, which is the only reason they don't move on here. But we go all the way back to Thailand and we have the first iteration of this and it's slightly different. It's individual, of course, again, because like this is the first time it's run in pairs. And instead of these steps that we usually see, which have like pegs that go into them, we have these puzzle pieces, for a lack of a better term. They kind of have this like goopy paint dripping, like Goosebumps font type of like puzzle that go together. Yeah. And there are, I think there are only 10 steps. It's not that high. They are not all in a pile together. They are driven into the ground.
Into the ground. Yeah.
And when we look at 47, we see that they have to go back to the puzzle pieces each time. In this original iteration, they could bring the puzzle pieces to the stairs and then work on it. So it's a bit different strategy that way. And this is a challenge that was actually like really close for a long time until the way that this challenge works, where it kind of snowballs towards the end, right? Like the less pieces you have to try, the faster it should take you towards the end. The first couple of pieces are going to be the hardest, just because you have so many options that can fit into them, just like any puzzle. But as you progress through it and towards the end, we get to the point where it's pretty neck and neck, and then Brian just gets that.
He had the better strategy leading up to it of like getting all the puzzle pieces to the steps, while some people were trying to like try multiple puzzle pieces on a step, or just in like Clay's case wasn't fast enough. Brian was just physically better than him.
Yeah. And then because of that, Brian pulls ahead and he's like three or four steps ahead at the end. And he does become a very dominant win just because of that early strategy. I think it's a really good indication of how much the strategy you take into a challenge can affect your results in a challenge. Your ability to win a challenge, because sometimes in these challenges, it is a matter of seconds, right? Mm-hmm. So shaving off seconds, even though it might not seem like it's doing anything in the meantime, because it's putting you behind, if you get that advantage where it's like, cool, now I don't have to run back and get another puzzle piece from the start because it's right here already. And it's enough to like get you up the stairs. Also, I mean, maybe some of the advantage is just the fact that Brian's taller than Clay.
Could be longer legs.
just being able to reach a little further so you don't have to go up as many stairs can be a massive advantage in this. And again, like I think we've seen production learn from these early iterations of the challenge with the way that the challenge has evolved over the years.
Though I do think this puzzle, like this step puzzle piece shape, we should try that again, because we won't have that moment of Sue and Genevieve. I mean, it was great for what it was for this moment, but now we have a hack. You know, it's like, look for the big piece. And if it's three in the middle, you know, there's your puzzle piece. You have to memorize less. So with this like paint drippy slime goop kind of piece, it is less like that. It's less hackable.
Yeah. It's one of those things that might not be relevant in the future because we may never see this challenge run in pairs again.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this might be a reason why we never see this challenge run in pairs again, because of how easy it is to communicate to everyone. So instead, I do like the variance though. Like, I think the thing is we've only seen this challenge a handful of times. We've seen it in Thailand, we've seen it in Redemption Island, in Cambodia, and David vs. Goliath.
And 44 or 2.
One other point in the new era. It's just a question of what type of variations can we make on it?
And there's also like the bridges where it's like the pieces on the side. Yeah, there's many other forms of like puzzle travel. Steps?
Travel? Yeah, way of building vessels for travel out of puzzles.
There's been a puzzle boat.
We had a puzzle wagon.
But you did mention Redemption Island, and that is my moment. I feel like we can't not mention Redemption Island with this challenge. It is one of my favorite moments. And it's Boston Rob winning that challenge at Final Six. I think it is one of the most grueling challenges because there are so many steps. It's ridiculous. And they're having to place one piece, go back down, place another piece, go back down, place another piece, go back down. So it's like, it's so grueling on the body. We see Rob collapse for a hot second and is like weak. So I know there's always like the meme of he's carrying his family on his back because he has the photo, but this challenge is just heightened to another level.
I think a lot of it comes down to just the fact that this is such a pivotal challenge in that season. And the scale of it is so much larger. Right? When we're looking at all these other variations of this,
it's like 10 steps, five steps, or not five steps, but like 10 steps.
Yeah, it tends to be what it is. But this one was longer. It was steeper. It was taller there. And it was after running through a massive obstacle course. So it just adds to this challenge and the spectacle of it. And also, I mean, it's Redemption Island. The entire season is literally edited around Rob winning it. Mm-hmm. So because of that, there's just so much more emphasis on how Rob is performing in this challenge and what Rob is doing. And the storyline of Rob is carrying his family on his back to win this game.
Yeah, this is just such a powerful challenge, an emotional challenge. And Rob just like releases it because he knows he has to win this to get Andrea out, to make sure, you know, he has his options, his ducks are in his rows, and he's so close to the end and this big threat, and he wins this insane challenge. It's an emotional challenge to watch, and it's one of the best parts of Redemption Island. I think there are two moments in Redemption Island where I'm like, yes, I like these. And then the others are just like, well,
what's the other one?
Throwing the clue into the volcano.
Yeah. Okay. It's just one of those moments that like feels like at this point, I think the big thing with this season and like this immunity challenge in Redemption Island, this feels like the difference in Boston Rob. This feels like Rob's determination is so strong in this instance, and he's not, yes, we've seen him kind of godfather his way through the game at that point, but it still feels like this is a different Rob than when we last saw him on All Stars. And this really epitomizes that, in my opinion. Heroes versus villains, that's right. I was thinking about the time when he went, I was thinking about the time that he went deep into the game, that's all.
Ah, got it. Yeah, so it would be interesting to throw new era people in with like even if we just have the steps as the challenge, because that's how it was in Thailand. It was just the steps. There was no like other element. And then you get to the steps. If we have just these like Redemption Island steps, throw the New Era people into it when they're like on this, you know, less food and running low, it would be interesting to see what happens.
You know what? You know what would make this challenge really interesting? If we had them run into the jungle to find their steps. I'm just saying, that's what it is. Have them run into the jungle to find their steps. Great challenge.
Only one bundle, though. The other three are back at the steps.
Yeah, but they're all buried in the sand in bags that will break.
That too. All right, so let's go head on over to our Outlast moment. We are going to talk the duel we had at this journey versus the type of duel we have in Blood versus Water Seasons versus the type of duel we have in San Juan del Sur, because this kind of did feel like a duel at the journey. We had these people facing off against each other, and only one wins. So what was interesting and new about this journey one is they all kind of played the challenge together, where the moments that we're talk about is like everyone has their own lane.
Yeah, it's very interesting because and this is the interesting think piece that this journey this time around has really kind of spawned, in my opinion, mainly because I'm talking about it on a podcast with you, McKenna. But are these journey moments like this, now that we've seen like head-to-head journey moments, and in retrospect, we've seen this a lot more in the New Era. We go back to the beginning of 46 with the stupid game that Jelinski, Tevin, and Maria had to play with the like lying and stuff like that. We go to the beginning of 47 where we've replaced Sweat and Savvy with this like scavenger hunt duel type thing. Mm-hmm. And now, again in 47, we have this reverse Jenga challenge. Are duels back in Survivor, and have we just not realized it?
I mean, maybe. And if, you know, the journeys are more like this and less like let's pull a scroll out of the bag, I think I'd be more here for it, where it's like you have a physical chance to save your vote rather than like let me try and feel this scroll to feel if it has the advantage written on it. You know, there's no, they have more control over their fate. So John, why don't you start off with your duel, because your people get to choose who goes.
Yeah. So when we're looking at duels, like we have the different types, right? We have the Redemption Island duels. And the only other time we've seen official duels was in San Juan del Sur, because they elected to not bring back Redemption Island for that Blood versus Water season. But they still wanted this tension between loved ones having to compete against each other. So we had the reward challenges in that season were duels. And one of my favorite duels of all time is the very last duel in San Juan del Sur. It's so fun. It's so ridiculous. It's just a challenge that sticks in my mind. And it is the one where the contestants are blindfolded, have to navigate obstacles to get to this display where they have to then feel a mask and figure out the facial construction of this mask, go back through the obstacles, and then replicate the mask still while blindfolded with a bunch of dummy pieces involved.
Yeah.
It's so fun. It's kind of like this fun aspect of Survivor that sometimes we don't get. Sometimes, I hate to say this, sometimes Survivor takes itself too seriously. And just the contrast in like the brightly colored wrong pieces to the right pieces in this challenge is so fun. It's so interesting to think about using touch as a sense. I don't feel like we use that as one of the senses in Survivor a lot. I think we fight a lot. And yeah, of course we have like touch with like strength and everything like that, but we don't use tactile senses a lot in Survivor.
Yeah.
Use communication when blindfolded challenge. So seeing people have to navigate through touch, we've seen it in some of like the older mazes and things like that that they have to navigate. But this is something that is so unique, and it's head-to-head, and you have no idea how well someone else is doing. It's kind of taking this combination of, like, old things we used to see on the journey with, like, the last time we saw people lose their votes when in 45, right, where they had their own personal thing that they had to do with the numbers and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's taking that aspect where you don't know how well your opponent's doing, but you're doing it simultaneously. It's better visually, which is so important. Sometimes I think Survivor forgets that it is a visual component, and you have to be made. Phil's been kind of harking on this a lot this season of, like, you have to make this show for the viewer because that's who's watching it. Mm-hmm. And yes, you want a good experience for the players, but the viewer also has to enjoy that experience in order for it to be successful. And this mask was successful because the viewers can easily tell what's going on. And because you had the audiences there watching, you could gauge how well you were doing in comparison to your opponent based on what your tribe was saying. It's just such an interesting idea for a challenge. And I think the execution really works well. And I think, I can't believe I'm about to say this, McKenna, I think duels might not be the worst thing in Survivor.
I don't think so either. Except if it's Redemption Island, that's not in Blood versus Water, but we'll get to that. What I like about San Juan del Sur is both season 47 and San Juan del Sur, there was an element of choice. You were able to choose who you were partnered up with in 47, and you were able to choose if you thought you could do the duel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was that, you know, element of, like, I feel confident with my skills in this obstacle course with the mask, and I feel confident with my partner. I mean, Andy and Sam got stuck together. I think they were the last two or something like that. Or Andy claimed Sam. Anywho. But there was, like, that element of choice of, like, I think I can do this because of X, Y, and Z, where my moment, I'm going to go into Blood versus Water. It's because it's a Redemption Island duel. They're dueling to get back into the game. They were voted out. They have no choice to compete in this duel. And I'm going to talk about the Laura Moret, Tina, and Katie duel, where they have to do the prisoner's escape. And Tina and Laura had been working together the entire time on Redemption Island. And then Tina's daughter joins, and they have to deal with, you know, redemption, dueling against each other as loved ones. So it's just such a dynamic challenge to watch because of, yes, Prisoner's Escape is a visual component, but because of the emotional battle that all three women are going through in this challenge.
I think that's one of the things that Blood versus Water, and why Blood versus Water kind of did Redemption Island well, was because there was that emotional impact to it, because there's a loved one that they're trying to work with or get to. When we get these moments where they get to compete against each other, it's huge. When we see, you know, Laura Moret is trying to get there through the fact that both people she is competing with are related to each other, like, there's a story there. And again, it does come, like, you're right, like, there is a visual component to it, but it can still be kind of hard to tell how well everyone's doing if we don't get the wide angle shots in the prison escape challenge. But
you're captivated because of the emotions
and the story being told, and that's what's important to Survivor. And that is one thing that I felt was lacking this week in this journey.
I felt the story a little bit because we have a little bit of camp life beforehand and thought and, like, reward talking, like, all right, we just need Caroline. So now I'm invested to see if Caroline loses her vote. Rachel has been this, you know, on the bottom kind of wild card. She also has an idol. Does she need to play it because she doesn't have a vote? I want to know where she ends up. Sam, blindsided at the last tribal council, his vote is imperative to be able to try and push a plan that's not him, because if his vote was lost, then maybe he is actually the one going home. And then you have Andy, who flipped on everybody and, you know, is trying to make his way in the game and carve his path. So this group of four, while three of them were on the same tribe together and Caroline, that does feel, you know, pretty bland. But then you really look into what is impacted with, you know, whoever loses the vote. There didn't have to be that scramble had Caroline not lost her vote.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you raise a good point. We do kind of get the drama of this episode because Caroline's the one to lose her vote. And mm-hmm. the question of, like, can we secure this? And it doesn't quite come off because we see the unanimous vote against Saul in the end.
Right.
But I do agree there is some story here. The mm-hmm. problem is, I think, the visual telling of it. And I, you know what? We haven't ragged on the editors a lot this season. We've commended them a lot.
I think what they were missing was just an overhead camera.
Not even an overhead camera. I think it's just this type of challenge goes on for a long time. I mean, we saw it, right? How many? I didn't count. I'm sorry, listeners. I did not count to see how many stacks they had gotten up. But mm-hmm. It gets up pretty high. There's like one moment of real tension where it's like, is Rachel going to be able to do this? But we don't even have a confessional from Caroline saying she like intentionally placed her card in a way to make it hard for Rachel to place it, right? I think that we just needed more of that aspect to it. I think we needed more confessionals, which is a weird thing to say because sometimes it feels like they over give us confessionals. But this was one of those instances where I think it would have really benefited because this had to have been a me versus the rest of them. I think it needed to be framed more like a duel, and it would have made it more entertaining for the
viewers. It was framed as a journey and less like a duel. And if it was more like a duel, we have like these emotional moments with blood versus water or like the visual aspect of San Juan del Sur that could have been put into this journey duel.
Do you think, McKenna, we can't call this a duel because there's no audience for it? Because that is something that was consistent in the duels in the past, right? There was always an audience.
Whether it was a tribe or just two viewers or something. Yeah. Yeah. I guess so.
But I think, like, honestly, Survivor, like, just break the stigma attached to some of the words you used in the past. Don't be afraid to use the word duel because people kind of look at Redemption Island and South Pacific as like not great seasons. The other two seasons that had duels,
listen, watch South Pacific, your life will be changed.
In one way or another. But I think like the thing is like I think they're scared to frame it as a duel. But and I think it is also because it's new, right? Like we haven't seen these head-to-head things and it hasn't been consistent. I think if we see Journey start being more head-to-head, we need to call them duels. And I think it changes the way people approach journeys in the game too. I think instead of, because right now people don't want to go on journeys.
Yeah.
Right. People are scared they're going to lose their vote. They are scared that they are going to, you know, or they'll come back and everyone thinks they have an advantage. At least if we have this dual aspect of the journey, A, it's more entertaining for the viewer. Mm-hmm. And B, I think it changes the approach because now it's like, oh, I don't have to beat this game that I may or may not be able to beat. I have to beat someone else.
Yeah.
And I think that adds a little bit more tension. I think it makes things a little more interesting. It also will probably make the conversations leading up to it while on the journey more interesting. Instead of it being like, hey,
you three are here.
One of you has to lose your vote or all of you lose your vote. And
yeah.
But like, one of you is losing your vote. Play a game. Let's do it head to head. See what happens. Who's coming out on top?
Yeah, exactly. So those are our outwit, outplay, outlast moments of the week. So make sure you catch us over on the Patreon watching episode 13 of Thailand. The tides are turning tomorrow on Saturday. And it was a great chat. John, what is happening in the Survivor Specialist universe?
Well, Wednesday we had Phil and Will go over episode 9. If you haven't listened to that, make sure you go over there. Phil and Blake dug a little deeper yesterday, and they went over how they view everyone's path to winning the game is now. It was a very insightful podcast. So if you haven't had a chance, go back and listen to that. Sunday, Phil is being joined by Todd Herzog for the predictions and power rankings. That is one you're definitely not going to want to miss, mainly because Phil's probably going to be fanboying over Todd the entire time. It'll be well worth it. Also, Todd, of course, very insightful about Survivor. That is definitely a podcast you're not going to want to miss. Over on the Patreon, Every Season's Matter is going deep in Panama now. Phil and I covered Singing in the Rain this last week, which was fantastic. What a movie that is. The Survivor Rock Draw is going on. Phil's after show. Phil is deep into Australian Survivor 2019 right now. You have the Rewind tomorrow. There's so much content coming out on the Patreon, so make sure to check that out. And then, of course, this coming Wednesday, Phil and Will will be back to recap episode 10, which, I mean, it's an odd number vote. Maybe it'll be the first regular vote of this season in the merge. Maybe no one will lose a vote and it'll be exciting. You'll definitely want to check that back. And then McKenna and I will be here next Friday, winding it all down again and rewinding, seeing what antics these survivors have us looking back to.
All righty. We'll catch you tomorrow or next week. Goodbye, everyone.